Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I just have two words. One, thank you. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, thank you all so much for being here and supporting our independently owned bookstore. You're all rock stars, and we love you for coming here tonight. And thanks to Christopher Moore for being the awesome author that he is. I don't think I need to tell you anything about him. Does everyone know who he is and what books he's written and all the acclaim he has gotten? All right. Then without further ado, please join me in welcoming Christopher Moore.
Hey.
Well, I met you all now. It's really not much. Are there any questions? No. Thanks to Tattered Cover. Thanks for supporting your locally owned bookstore. It's awesome. How cool is this book that it's a cool book? You know, all your friends are like, I read everything on the Kindle. You can go check this shit out. Yeah. You got this on your Kindle? That's all I'm saying. So, while we're doing thanks, I wanted to start this. I just spent 4 years basically researching artists and what's behind what they do and what it took to make their art. And there was a period of time where I had to stop working on this and write Bite Me so I could make my house payment, and then start working on this again. And I realized in studying the trials and tribulations of all these famous artists, how lucky I am to do what I do. And the only reason I'm allowed to do that is because you guys will buy my dumb books and come here and listen to me tell you stories and whatnot. And so, you know, before I go any further, I just want to let you know that in writing this book, if I wasn't grateful before, I certainly am now. And thank you all very much for letting me do what I do and allowing me to do it. So anyway, there you go. Thank you. Okay, that said, I really don't have too much prepared. But I've figured out over the years that probably one of the reasons that my books resonate with you and that you like my stuff is that you kind of go, well, I could have done that if I had time. So it's basically my lack of skill that is my charm. So if I got up here and like hit all the beats and whatnot in public speaking, you'd go, oh, you know, he's too polished. He's too shiny. He has a teleprompter. But I don't. Let's see. I got a letter the other day from a woman who said, thank you for my work because it had come out just in time to save her in the midst of a kitchen fire, a burn-up stove, and a colonoscopy. And I, as a public service, because I like you guys, I want to tell you that if your colonoscopy causes a kitchen fire, you need to change doctors. You know, I'm all about public service, and it just, I didn't write back and go, splain, because I'm not sure I wanted to know. But just saying, if that's a thing. I'm a little goofy but not only because you guys have air light here, but also I just lost 30 pounds. I haven't eaten carbs in 3 months. And I know you're going, you look exactly the same way you did before when you were here, but that's true because I had just lost 30 pounds then too. It's baby weight. I deliver a book and then I lose 30 pounds. And so that's why, yeah. I mean, it's only, I have these pants I've had for like 10 years because I can only wear them when I'm on book tour because that's the only time I'm skinny enough. The rest of the time I'm like out there bitching about, oh, my back, I'm giving birth to a book. So anyway. But this time, the thing that was different was usually when I lose my 30 pounds, there's like muscle and bone and stuff. And this time there was just like old man and nose hair underneath it. So it was unbelievable. It was like the first time I've had to tour with like one of those things that trims all your orifice hair. And so I know when you're going through line, a lot of you have already stood in line and you were very polite in the book. And I know you're going to be like, I'm going to have to look at his nose hair. Don't. Because it makes me self-conscious. But if you're like 12 people down, you can kind of look. The hat thing, I got to explain. I've been going to see Elmore Leonard speak for like 35, 38 years. And he wears a hat like this. So I figured, oh, I can wear a hat like this. And the thing about Elmore Leonard, this is what I should realize when the whole nose hair explosion happened, was that when I first started going to see him, he was about, you know, this big, and he's 86 now, and he's like 7 inches tall. He's basically just hat and glasses now. So if you guys stick with me and I keep writing books, it'll basically, they're just going to have to stand me up here. So I'm just growing into my hat. Anyway, so that happened. Let's see. My wife-like girlfriend bought me this shirt. She bought me a bunch of these shirts, and I was like, I don't know about this shirt. And she goes, and this was her selling point, because this was just for tour. I have three of these, and they were like stupid expensive. She wouldn't even tell me how much they cost. And I like, I don't know if this is me. And she goes, oh, you know the big gay clown on Modern Family? He wears them. These are very special shirts. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then, so I'm all right with that. I don't have to get the big gay clown shoes, so I'm fine. But then I realized that I might be, my species is coming forth. I mean, you know, I'm totally not, I don't have any issues about gay people. I just, in China, they found a feathered Tyrannosaurus rex like 4 days ago, discovered a. So you know there was a big, giant, gay dinosaur. Just like, it's like, I'm going to eat you and I'm fabulous. And so, yeah. So, and I didn't think too much about that, you know, in the connection until I was having lunch with a writer friend of mine in Seattle yesterday. I won't say his name because it would be embarrassing. And I realized that all of my friends who are writers, you know, he had on a t-shirt and their arms are, they have these tiny little arms because they're just, you know, they have, like you guys were all, don't you get, you know, like a cramp, you know, when you're, no, we can do this all day, but nothing else, you know? And I was just going, that's the thing, is that we have like Tyrannosaurus Rex arms. All writers have these little, tiny, like, fabulous arms. So this is my perfect shirt, is all I'm saying, I guess. So, you know, she nailed that. So anyway, I'm just learning to live with the whole ear hair, nose hair thing. Although I think I would like to see it, you know, I would like to view it as a superpower rather than a, you know, because it's not really, you're not going to get a parking place for, like, dude, nose hair. So it's to a point where it would be an asset, where the president would be like, in our multi-stepped energy approach, we're going to use wind and solar and petroleum as well as Chris's nose hair. And because I love when the president does that and he's, you know, dumbing it up for us because, you know, in his head, he's like, zoo, 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 cosine squared to the fifth power cosine, you know, because that's, he's so, I love that. Don't get me wrong, I'm not criticizing the president. I love that he's way smarter than me, because I've had it the other way. you know, there were points where I was going, you know, the Scotty dog Barney, why don't you just let him run things? How much worse could he fuck it up? You know? Well, it turns out that relations with Yemen broke down today. Barney chewed up all their shoes. We're at war now. So, the new thing, speaking of presidential dogs, the president's dog and the succubus on the Sci-Fi Channel have the same name. Kablam. I have exploded your mind. I'm serious. What's it called? Lost Girl, named Bo. President's dog, named Bo. Coincidence? Kennedy had a secretary named Lincoln. Lincoln had a secretary named Kennedy. The president's dog has the same name as a big supernatural slut on the Sci-Fi Channel. I don't know what's going on, but there's something. Geraldo would know. Anyway, so we did that. We did that. You know, with your air, your light air up here, I feel like there's a lot of things I don't understand. You guys who are coming through getting your book signed, you realize I didn't understand what you were saying a lot of times. And I realized that that's how a lot of people go through life. And it's okay. I write characters like that, and it's like, wow, there's just a lot more magic in your world. When my girlfriend unlocks the car, she's like, boop, boop. I'm like, whoa. If I was in Denver, I would have been anyway. So, and that really explains Kansas. It's like just all this shit is magical, and that's why they're right. I'm debating whether to tell you this story. So last night, I sort of said a lot of things about Kansas. Now, here's my point about saying things about people being stupid in Kansas. And they're not probably stupid. They just aren't speaking up. But my point was, everybody's like, oh, don't say the bad things about Kansas. And I was like, no, here's my point. My point is, if you don't agree with the thing I'm saying about people in Kansas and you're from Kansas, you're not in Kansas anymore. You know? So then we came to question time, and the guy came up in the front, and it was a crowd about the same makeup of this, a little bit different. And he goes, why are you saying all the bad things about us in Kansas? And I said, I don't think it's about you. And he said, well, how do you know? And I said, okay, this audience is about 75% women. Do you want to tell them what they can do with their reproductive junk? And he went, no. And I said, well, then we're not talking about you. So sit down. Anyway, I know I'm in a little blueberry surrounded by tomato juice. I know. I know. You know, I'm going to talk about the book, but, you know, it's a book about the color blue. Questions? So, anyway, yeah, so if you were, like, unlocking the car in Kansas, it'd be like, boop, boop, ksh, witch, burn her! So, as I was leaving to go, I don't know why I have Kansas material. I mean, it's fortunate I'm not going there. ever. But at the gate in San Francisco at the airport, they have a miniature working tornado. Not kidding at all. It's like, I have pictures of it. I can't show you. It's under my phone, and I don't know where that is. But anyway, I was thinking, why would you put this here? And I thought, well, it's either for homesick Texans who are just coming into San Francisco, or it's like our Statue of Liberty in San Francisco for Friends of Dorothy who are returning, you know? welcome, you're gay, you're fashion challenged. So anyway, what was I talking about? Oh, I wrote this book about the color blue. And I don't, when something like this happens, when you come up with a concept like this, and you guys know I've done this a number of times, it's like, oh yeah, I'm going to write the life of Jesus as a comedy. You know, just kind of stuff that's really doesn't make too much sense. Then afterwards, people on radio and stuff ask you, well, what was your process? What was your inspiration? Now, I do remember having the phrase come to me, I'm going to write a book about the color blue. And even going to dinner at a friend's house and going, I think I'm next, you know, my next book I'm going to write about the color blue. But I don't know where exactly that came from. You know, what I was thinking. Okay, let me give you an example. I was thinking, well, you know, meerkats live in these little communities. I wonder where they get their pizza at. It's that kind of process, you know, which makes people so. But if you tell people that it's just like, I just thought it, then they go, oh, you were high. Where you live in California where they have medical marijuana, right? And I was like, well, yes, but I don't have a condition. One of my books, I had the guy show the cop his library card, and he's like, that's not a condition. He's going, no, reading makes me anxious. Because everybody I know that's using medical marijuana, it's for anxiety. And I'm like, oh, okay, sure. There was a guy actually in L.A. County last week that got robbed. The state's cracking down on all the medical marijuana. Do you guys have medical marijuana? And they're cracking down on all the dispensaries. And yeah, it was like, woo! Why do you think we sat here for 3 hours? enjoying the shit out of your shirt. They're cracking down on all the dispensaries in California. And so they're starting to do a delivery thing where you call your prescription in. And a delivery guy in LA County got robbed, and I'm not kidding you. And in the old days, if the pot guy got robbed and then went back and said, well, I don't have an ounce that I went out with, then they go, oh, we had to kill you now. But now there's like due process because it's legal, right? So you have to like file a grievance and shit. So I guess you just see this in the investigation. They said, well, did you see your assailant? And he was like, no. And this is, honest to God, you can Google it when you get home. They say, like, well, who robbed you? And he says, I didn't see him because they were ninjas. And they put it in the LA Times, pot delivery man robbed by 6 ninjas. So I totally understand when people go, you were just high when you thought that up, because that's the situation. It was like, okay, I was robbed because ninjas. Shit cracked me up. Why didn't I think of that? Anyway, I think they should all unionize the pot delivery guys, just because, I don't know why, health insurance. So anyway, I decided to write this book about the color blue. And I had been going to museums all the time I go on book tour. When I go on book tour, I basically what happens is you go to a city and you get up, you go to the airport, you go to a new city, there's somebody that picks you up, and you go to radio stations and talk to them, or some places you go TV. If you're a novelist, there's not much TV. Usually it's like, how you doing Minneapolis, and it's like 6 a.m. and you're on after the poison control guy and before the turtle woman from the zoo, and the only people watching are incarcerated, so you don't really sell any books or anything, you know, but you get some you're a very attractive man letters. Should wear that shirt more often. But all you're doing is talking about yourself and your book, yourself and your book, yourself and your book, everywhere you go. And you just, as you guys are probably already realizing just 15 minutes in here, you get so sick of it, so much, you can't stand yourself. So what I would do in the 2 hours I had down in a city is I go out to art museums and look at painting. And I don't have any background in art, but that's just what I would do. And I would look, and the cool thing about American art museums, Denver's included, is that when America had a lot of Industrial Revolution money, France had a lot of painters they didn't like. So in the United States, we have some of the finest collections of Impressionist painting of any museums in the world. Some of them rival the museums in Paris. The Chicago Museum of Art, or the Art Institute, rivals some of the museums in Paris. And so I would be in Chicago one day looking at 16 Monets in a room, and the next day in another room looking at 16 different Monets. And after you look at art for a couple of hours, after you look at great painting, and I'm not analytical about it, I'm just looking at pictures and how it's been filtered through a consciousness, something shifts, and you start to see everything as art. Everything starts to compose. The people looking at the pictures look like they're supposed to be there, like, you know, how people start to look like their dogs. My friend Lisa just got a French bulldog, so I'm looking. I'm keeping an eye on her ears. I remember specifically the Chicago Institute of Art. I was in their cafeteria, and I had been looking at painting for a few hours. And there was this woman, she was probably 90, and she was eating green beans. And every green bean was like, it was just like a painting. And I saw she was in the same place. It was the texture and the color and the crunch of the green beans. And I was seeing it as a work of art, and she was seeing it as a work of art. So I realized I wasn't the only one. It wasn't just trying to get away from me that made this happen to people. And I shagged her on the table right there. And it was awesome. Not disgusting. She had like the body of an 85-year-old. So it was... that didn't really happen. I just don't have a really good ending for that anecdote. The other part, it was true right up to the last part. I've read writings by a guy named Kandinsky, a painter from the 19-teens, who talks about, he says, art, when it does what it's supposed to do, smooths the coarseness of the soul. And I thought, that's exactly what it does. It's exactly, because it's not about you, it's somewhere else, and it's transformative. And it's not as spooky as I make it sound, but the best thing is you don't need to have a background, and people are sort of alienated by art. And I'm a cop's kid from Ohio, you know? I'm just walking through looking at pictures. And I realized, when I started to, put together the idea for this book on blue, that a lot of these Impressionist pictures that I'd been looking at were predominantly blue. And the Impressionists sort of get dismissed by people who are into modern art and edgy art because they're pictures of, like, water lilies and fields of poppies and little pink cheek girls and stuff like that. They're a little soft kind of, and after you've seen your, 10,000th Monet tote bag, I can understand maybe it seems to be a little diluted and so forth. But the thing about Impressionist art is it all sort of is predominantly blue. And Impressionism happened for a lot of different reasons, but one of the reasons was the paint started to come in tubes, tin tubes. And before then, it would always be in like sheep bladders, and it would have to be mixed in a studio and kept in like jars and so forth, and it wasn't really portable. But now it's in tubes, which meant that people could go outside and paint. And so they were painting what they saw. That was their goal. And they were painting in daylight, ultraviolet light, which is what color? Blue. So they weren't deciding to make it blue. They were just painting what they saw. And so when you take all those paintings and put them in a gallery, they look blue. And so that became the takeoff for this book. And I started to learn about these guys. And it turned out that there was something beyond these pink-cheeked little girls in these fields of flowers, because painting... For 500 years, from when they started painting in churches and for churches, it was run by the church. And then it was, when France had their revolution, it was run by their academy. They had an academic. They're the people that they exist today, and they're always mad because American words work their way into the French language. You know, it's like, no, we don't want a quarter pounder. they were that way about painting. And you could paint... It was a perfectly legitimate job choice if you were a French person to become a painter. There were 18,000 professional painters in Paris in 1850. So it was like, I want to be a doctor, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be an accountant, a banker. It was a thing you could go do as a profession. and there was a course, but the course meant that you had to be accepted by the Academy and exhibited in this big salon that they would do in a palace every year, and if you didn't, you couldn't work. Nobody would buy your paintings, and you couldn't get commissions from rich people to do portraits. But there were a group of guys who started to say, no, I'm going to paint what I see. I'm not going to paint what you tell me. Because you couldn't, you know, there was a painting that showed up. There was one year, 3,000 painters were rejected from the salon. That meant 3,000 guys who were professional quality painters who weren't going to be able to make a living. And Napoleon III, who was running the country at the time, was not really popular and needed to do something to make the people feel better. So he said, we're going to have a salon of the rejected. And so they did another palace full of the guys that got rejected. And there was a painting there called Luncheon in the Grass by Edouard Manet. And it was called something in French, but you guys would make fun of my pronunciation, so I'm not going to say that. And because they always do. And it was basically this naked woman sitting on the riverbank with these two guys who were clothed and a woman in the background. It wasn't really that scandalous. It was based on a Titian painting called The Judgment of Paris. In the salon, the official salon, there were hundreds of nudes, but they were all Venus or Athena or Minerva or Leda. They were, you weren't allowed to, you could paint nudes, you just, they had to be a goddess. You had to paint in a certain way and bring it up from dark to light. And that's why all the paintings you see from the Renaissance, like Caravaggio, are black in the background and the light comes forward. But these guys weren't going to do that. And they saw this painting, this Luncheon in the Grass, and they went, this is the change. And everybody in Paris was scandalized by this painting because it was real. She was a real Parisian woman sitting on a real Parisian riverbank with real Parisian guys. And you just weren't supposed to do that. And these young artists, Monet, Renoir, Pizarro, Cezanne, they saw this and they went, okay, we're doing what we're going to do. And they started painting. And for 25 years, they weren't recognized for what they were doing. And it was up against survival. In the book, there's a picture of this painting I'm talking about. And there's a story behind it in the gallery. But these guys were going against everything that was pro-survival in order to pursue an idea. And it suddenly gave a lot of depth to all these paintings of, you know, pink-cheeked little girls and fields of flowers and water lilies, because it was an act of courage that they did. For a long time, to get up every day and go out and paint and not even know if you could feed your family because you weren't allowed. And then, all of a sudden, an art dealer, a guy named Durand, one of those two, he grabs a bunch of paintings and he brings them to New York in 1896. And everybody in, or I'm sorry, 1886. And there won't be a test. and the Americans start buying it. But it really gave me an idea of, well, let me give you an idea of why I related to it. When I first started out, I was waiting tables and I thought I was a horror story writer. And there was this anthology of horror stories that came out, a big thing about this big called Dark Forces. And I don't know where my water is. And it was edited by a guy named Kirby McCauley, who was the agent for Stephen King and Dean Koontz and Peter Straub, all the superstars. He was called the agent of the superstars. And he supposedly knew more about horror than anybody. And in the foreword to this, he said, the reason I think that horror is so popular is it can be combined with any element at all and still work, except whimsy. You can't have a whimsical horror novel. It just doesn't work. The two elements don't work together. So after I took the salads to table 5, I went, what does he know? I think I'm going to write a whimsical horror novel. And I wrote Practical Demon Keeping. And that was 22 years ago, and so here I am, 13 books later, and it turns out, well, he was wrong. Making a pretty good living writing whimsical horror stories. So, suck on it. But it made me relate to, you know, it made me relate to these guys, you know, going ahead and doing what they wanted to do. So, anyway, that is sort of what this book is the story of. as well as the story of the baker who kept these guys alive. He's not the Lucien Lessard and his father were not real people. They're the characters in the book, but they're based on a real guy who actually, if you know, I say in the book, you went to if you were a starving artist, you went to Montmartre to starve, and Monsieur Lessard was the one who kept you from doing it. And it was there was a baker named Edward Muir who fed Renoir and Monet in their starving moments, and hung their paintings in his bakery and kept them alive so that they could, you know, go on to be very famous artists. So anyway, that happened. So when I was researching this book, I learned to paint a little bit. As you guys that have been coming to hear me, you know I do this. I go where the book takes place, even if it was historical, and you know that was suffering 2 months in Paris, and it is a tough job. Did I thank you guys for that? But like when I did Island of Sequin Love Nun, I learned to fly helicopters a little bit, and I wouldn't say though of the two, if you're going to learn something a little bit, painting would be the one you'd want to go with, because. You know, the worst going to happen is like, oh, I splattered my shoes. When I was learning helicopters, I went up with my instructor. I was up at like 1,600 feet, and he goes, in the headphones, because you can't hear each other, and he goes, so Chris, you know in the movies when they're flying along and the pilot has a heart attack and the novice calls the tower and the tower talks him down and the novice lands the plane? And I go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he goes, if I have a heart attack, your life expectancy is about 15 seconds. And I went, really? How is your cholesterol? So anyway, I learned to paint. I didn't get good. I went through different periods where I would just paint red cars. So our whole house was filled with paintings. Because cars are way easier than people. And you know, I like red stuff. So I painted red cars, and I want to say, though, as a sort of a side note, that you know I didn't really go through a blue period, but if you have a blue period, see a urologist, because it only really worked for it's not natural except for Picasso. So I'm just saying. Speaking of that, I got to know: do you guys do Twitter? I'm not going to Twitter you. Don't worry about your privacy. I'm just saying. But occasionally they'll just go, you know who you should follow, who we think you should follow, like Netflix does or Amazon does, whatever. And so they said, we think you should follow Kotex. And I was... I didn't have the shirt then, but that's a good point. Maybe Kotex could see that. I was like, what in my demographic made you think I should follow? I went to Kotex's Twitter feed to see what. Kotex does not have that much to say. Except maybe you should try Kotex. I was like, yeah, I've been a little cranky, but that's just because I haven't been eating carbs. So, anyway, so I don't believe their shit about Kotex. That was. Kotex is trying to fool you. With wings. So I tried some of those Georgia O'Keeffe flower paintings that look like a vajayjay. And my girlfriend kept falling off the vase, so that didn't work out. It's a sense of balance, really, that we didn't have. The painting part was not that hard. So anyway, that happened. I tore the last page off. That's sad. Oh, happy Passover. Is it still Passover? Or are we over? We over. Oh, Shabbat Shalom, bitches. Yeah, we did that with last night. I was like, oh, how offended are you going to be? You're at my event on Passover when you should be doing Seder, you know. And I am sort of an honorary, I write comedy. I'm not Jewish, but my girlfriend is, and I write comedy, so I'm sort of an honorary Jew, you know, sort of a stealth Jew, a ninja, if you would. Anyway. So I get to tell those jokes, you know, just, you know, the same way I live in San Francisco and can tell jokes about Kansas. Anyway, so that's it. I'm going to take questions in a minute, and I'll repeat the questions back and whatnot. But we have a thing. A lot of you guys got your books signed beforehand, and a lot of you didn't. So, I mean, and I think they asked if we've already had our moment together, then, you know, get out. Not now. No, but, I mean, allow other people to do that. So how many people still need to get their book signed? Okay, so I won't talk that long. Just needed to do a little survey there to, you know, how many questions I was going to take. So does anybody, again, I'm gonna loop back around and say, anyway, so after studying all that, doing all that, writing this goofy book, and all you guys being here, again, thank you for letting me do what I do. I do appreciate it. So. So, anybody got any questions? Anyone? Sure, that guy. He asked me if I ever thought about doing an anthology of stories with my characters in it. You know, I have actually just recently thought about doing a sort of a novel in short stories. One of the problems with doing the characters repeating, I know you guys like it and I like doing it because I figure it's kind of a treat for you when you go, hey, I know that guy, is it drives Hollywood nuts. One of the questions that's going to happen is why aren't they making any of the movies? And one of the reasons, I don't think it's a huge reason, but what does get in the way somewhere along the line is they go, what do you mean Alphonse Rivero is in 7 books? Our contract says we own everything. And this has just come up recently, and it's this huge sort of fight over, I signed a contract with Disney 22 years ago for Practical Demon Keeping, and I literally was waiting tables when they called. And they said, yeah, we're going to give you hundreds of thousands of dollars and make a movie out of your book. And I went, okay. But, you know, so I will admit I did not go through the contract with a fine-tooth comb looking for reasons to say no. But one of the things it said, and we just found this out 2 months ago, it said any character that ever appears in any novel in any form in the future or any kind of work in the future, we consider a sequel and we own it. And I went, and I didn't know this until some attorneys who were working on a different movie of a book, you know, said, hey, do you know this about the Disney contract? And I'm like, no, dude, I haven't looked at that in 20 years. And they had found this clause that said that. So, you know, we had to go like, and the people at Disney, you know, that we did the deal with are dead. But, because you don't fuck with a mouse. So, anyway, so I would love to do that, but whether I'm able to do that, I have considered doing. I have a couple of books to just anticipate your questions. Right now, I'm working on a book where I bring back Pocket from Fool, and I send him to Venice. Yeah. I send him to Venice, and he's in two different, you know, I take two other Shakespeare plays and throw in there because it just wasn't hard enough to do one. So that's what I'm working on now, and then after that I want to do a sequel to A Dirty Job. So I pretty much got my next 4 years or so booked up. But after that, yeah, I would consider doing that. So, yeah, sure.
In the Louvre, in the Salon of the Louvre, about the woman's figure.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I think Van Gogh's Sunflower is one of the scariest paintings on the earth. But my question is, the paintings that you picked for the book, are these your favorites that you wanted to pull out for the book and, you know, and use to illustrate some of the things that are going on? Or did you write were you thinking about what was going on first and then go try and find a painting to match?
She asked me, did I pick the paintings to illustrate what was going on in the book, or did I write the book around the paintings? And it went a couple of different ways. There was a long, long battle about whether I was going to get art at all in the book and whether I was going to get... And I was asking early on. I mean, I hadn't even written 5 chapters, and I was calling my editor. I'm going, look, I need to know whether there's going to be pictures in this book, because some of these pictures, like the one, the, you know, Déjeuner sur l'Herbe, is... That's a seminal art history... Shut up. You knew what I was talking about. You guys have to know what I'm talking about. So I was either going to have to describe that in detail, or I was going to have to put a picture of it in. And I needed to know whether there was going to be a picture of it in. And so for a while, they were like, yeah, but it can be black and white. So I picked pictures that would represent in black and white. Because some of the ones I had picked, like there's some Michelangelos in there that are meaningless if you can't see the color. Because they're not there because of the content. They're there because the blue parts aren't painted, and it fits into the story. So it went both ways. Some of them, like the portraits of the artists, are there so you can see what Pizarro looked like and what Renoir looked like and what Monet looked like. The paintings, like a couple of Monet's paintings, so the Gare Saint-Lazare, the train station, is there because that's a great anecdote, and it's true that Monet said to Renoir at breakfast, I'm going to paint smoke and steam. And Renoir said, you're a madman, it can't be done. And Monet went down to the station and did it. And the story is in the book. I won't ruin it for you, but the stuff that he says, the stuff with Lucien and the other characters isn't there, but the stuff he says to the manager happened and is recorded, and where he went in and said, yet I am the painter Monet, and I have decided to paint your station. And he didn't have money for breakfast, but he just came in with so much confidence that they fired all the trains up and the manager was scuffling around. So some of the paintings were picked for the historical value. Some were to give you, to actually illustrate the book, for different reasons. They're not – some I didn't put in because – I thought everybody knew him. I think that I thought there was a vocabulary. Like, there's not a picture of Starry Night in the book, because I think people know that. Now, that said, if you guys go to sacrebleu.me, or if you don't remember that, chrismoore.com, you can follow the links to the chapter guide for this book. And every single piece of art mentioned in this book is there online, along with how they made the color, along with a lot of paintings of historical sites like the Place Pigalle, which is, I just have the paintings of those places and drawings of those places because that's what it looked like then. And you guys can go, oh, that's what it looked like then. And in fact, it doesn't look that different now because Paris, they tore it all down in the 1850s and rebuilt it. So it kind of is all consistent. But so multiple purposes. Some of them aren't my favorites, in fact. And I would have had different choices. But we went through, there was such a battle that when they finally said yes to color art, I didn't change back. And a lot of the ones I had picked because they had a contrast that would show up in black and white. And specifically the one I'm thinking of is like any of them that are drawings. Like there's a drawing of Seurat, and there's a portrait, and a drawing by Whistler. And I wouldn't have picked those had, I hadn't previously. I just didn't want to. It's like when someone says you win, stop selling. And that was that point, and the way this happened, another story is they told me in advance, no color art. And then they said, well, maybe we'll put color plates in the middle. You remember those kind of books when you were a kid? And I was like, okay, I can do that because people can flip to the middle of the book. And then when I turned the book in, she said, oh, no, we're not going to do color plates. That's too expensive. And I was like, well, then I go and I pick all black and white stuff and figure out where they're going to fall in the book. And then I see Steve Martin's book, An Object of Beauty, and it's a novel illustrated with color art. And I go on Amazon and I send it to my publisher, my editor, head of marketing, and I go, I sell way more books than Steve Martin. do you just love him more than me? And I go, you know, technology has changed. You guys can't act like it's alchemy anymore. Because they used to do this. When I first got into business, they would go, well, I don't know, the resetting of the type and stuff like that. And I go, you guys, I can do this shit at home. You know, because they had for years. They would always make it sound like, oh, there's these guys in this mystical place that make books. And, you know, and it was like, no, you know, the technology changed. You can put color pictures in the book. So this first printing, which is pretty big, is color pictures. And they said after this, we're not going to do it after this. This is the last time. You know, it's like when the guy, you know, you're going to have sprinkles and nuts on your Sunday, but not after this. No? So, any other questions? Yeah, sure, here. Have I read any good books lately? I read a book, it's been out a couple of years, called Beat the Reaper by a guy named Bazil. Bazil, is that it? I don't know his first name. Josh Bazil, I think. And it's a first novel, and when I say this, it literally jumps the shark in the last two chapters. But it's a real well-paced, kind of interesting first novel about a guy who's a doctor in a New York hospital, but also in the witness protection program. And I like that. I mean, I read so many things that are god-awful that it's nice to say, but it really does kind of, it goes all lost on you at the end. But you know, you gotta give him that because it was his first book. And I'm reading one now that doesn't come out until July called Up Jumps the Devil by a guy named John Paulo, I think, or Pollard or something like that. And it's from the point of view of the devil. And it's written sort of through the 30s in the U.S., through the 60s and jumps back to the 30s and stuff. And the devil is a real charming, sort of great character. He tells most of it. So that's got, I'm not finished with it yet, but it's sort of promising. So those are two good ones that I've read. And, you know, Othello. So, which is, you know, jury's out. Yeah, sure. What do I like least and best about being a writer? I like doing this a lot. Yeah, I like coming out and talking to you guys because it's spontaneous. That's what I miss about writing books is you tell a joke and then 18 months later you find out whether it was funny or not. The part I like least is necessary. It's absolutely necessary. The part I like least is locking myself in a room for 18 months and telling people, no, I can't go to lunch. It really is a job. Because everybody that comes to town is like, oh, you don't work. You can go out. And I'm like, no, I actually have to do this. So the discipline of it is what I like least. The things I like best are talking to you guys and just coming up with something. Just hitting... You know, sometimes it's an idea, and you just go, that's so friggin' cool, I can't stand it. You know, in research, things will line up. You know, there's a scene out of history where Monet's wife was dying, and she was on her deathbed, and she was turning a particular shade of blue, and he grabbed his palette and his canvas and said, I have to capture this, and that painting exists. And I was like, oh, fuck yeah. I mean, for this story, it's awesome. And I've stood in front of that painting. And that tells you more about this guy than any number of novels I could write could tell you, is that this is what he thought of at the time when his life companion was passing, was I have to capture that moment on canvas. So you know, good or bad, it was that sort of stuff happens. And it happens when you... there's a passage in the scene writing about Gauguin. It's three paragraphs long. And I worked, and I remember, I don't know how long I worked on it, but I just, normally nobody sees my stuff, anybody, until it's done. And my girlfriend walked in my office, you know, and asked me, you know, do I need bread or whatever? And I go, listen to this. And I read it to her. And you get those moments. And I don't think that I'm that awesome, but there's times when it just everything lines up and you solve the Rubik's Cube by accident, you know? And that was one. And she goes, you worked all morning on that, didn't you? You know? And it was like three paragraphs long. And I go, I did. It's awesome. So that's, you know, writing is the best part of it. And writing is the worst part of it. So any other questions? Yeah, over here.
I think you just started to answer that, but can you talk to me a little bit about what is fun for you about reimagining history and imagining literature?
what's fun for me about reimagining history and literature? Having what's really fun is knowing what someone says when I take things that are, that have source material, whether it's history or, you know, Shakespeare in that one case, or the Bible. It's having the, you know, you, one of the great things in life is to think that you had the right thing to say, but it never occurs to you until like 2 hours after you're home from the party, or you could, when you could have put that jerk in his place. If you would have, that's what I should have said. Well, when you write fiction, you have all the time in the world. So basically, some of the straight lines that I have in Lamb, somebody delivered 2,000 years ago. And I have 2,000 years to think up the joke. And so that's one of the fun, you know, Shakespeare was great that way because, you know, King Lear is just whining through the entire play. And I get to have somebody call him a whiner through the entire play and make fun of him for being a whiner. You know, maybe if that hadn't, you know, and you know, there's a point in Fool where Lear says, I've given my kingdom away and betrayed my only loyal daughter, and Pocket says, kind of like being hit on the bolt on the road to Damascus, isn't it? You know? that revelation was hidden in the forest longer than I was, because he's just been lost for like 3 weeks. But that's kind of the best part about it. It's the hardest part is making it fit and finding the source material. Then there's stuff that you just can't resist that you know you shouldn't do. You know, I'll give you a couple examples. One in this book is when we first meet Whistler. Manet and Whistler were friends, which I thought was important. And Manet goes, "So, Whistler, how's your mother?" And I know I shouldn't have put that in the book, because it really wasn't something Edward Manet would have said. But it's for me and you guys. And there's the part in Lamb where Biff says in A Real Revelation, he says, "You really do love them, don't you?" And Josh says, "Yeah, I do. I love them all. Red and yellow, black and green." And Biff says, "Really? Green?" And Josh says, "No, I was just fucking with you." And I had been told like by 4 people, they said, "You can't have Jesus say fuck." And I was like, it just doesn't work any other way. I had to have that in the book. So that's the funnest part about it. So another question? Yeah, gentleman in the check shirt.
What's the hottest book you researched?
I can't hear you. I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
What's the hottest thing to research out of your books?
The most difficult thing to research? This was probably the most difficult because there was too much source material. When I did Fool, the big research projects were, you know, Fluke, Fool, Lamb, this. Or did I say this? Anyway, you have this air light. I can't expect my brain to work. When I did Lamb, I mean, the whole reason to do that was I heard somewhere at PBS or something that there's 30 years of Christ's life that nobody wrote down. And I was like, you know, I should do that. So, and when I started researching King Lear, it was a single source. But when I started doing the history, I was going around, you know, England and looking at medieval places, and I realized his time frame is completely wrong. It's, you know, King Lear existed in 400 BC. There were no castles. There was no earls and knights and dukes and all this stuff. He's got 16th century English royalty, what do you call it, hierarchy, in 400 BC when it was basically mud huts and Greeks. So I got to do whatever I wanted to do. You know, I just had to sort of loosely stay to the text. But when I got to do the Impressionists, they know what these guys had for breakfast every day for, you know, 50 years. So there was so much material that it was just a point of saying, I have to stop. I can't do anymore. I mean, Cezanne and Degas don't have very big parts in this book, not because they weren't great artists, but because I had to make the decision. And it says in the afterwards, everybody who was anybody in the late 1890s or the late 1800s was in Paris. Anybody you could name from that period was there. So making a story with those characters wasn't the problem. The problem was who to leave out and how far to go into it. And so I would say this was definitely the most difficult book to research of them. I could have just said this one and not told you all that other stuff, huh? Sorry. Yes, back there. What? What movie will you be seeing? I'm really reluctant to tell you will be seeing a movie. Stupidest Angel is supposed to start shooting in June, but they've been supposed to start shooting. They've been a couple of weeks from starting three times, and then some financier has fallen out. So I don't want to. That's the one most likely to probably kind of maybe get made. Dirty Job looks okay. It's got a good script. I mean, I like the script, but there's nobody attached to it yet except a director, and he's only done one movie, so you can't go, well, it's got Scorsese, it's a movie. So so probably if you're going to see one in, you know, my lifetime, it'll probably be The Stupidest Angel. But I'll tell you, they were supposed to, this is how much confidence, they were supposed to be filming now, and I'm in it. And I'm here. So that's how much confidence I have in when I think they're going to actually get started. Sure.
So two questions. One, her question, who are you playing in this movie? And any chance of a Broadway adaptation?
Who am I playing in the movie? I play me. I have a Santa hat on and I'm claymation. And and in preparation for my role as Elmore Leonard, I'm 7 inches tall. Seriously. Like, you remember in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Burl Ives goes through as a snowman and he narrates? That's who I am. For seriously. I'm like in a snow globe. I have to like do the Stanislavski method and I have to feel being 7 inches tall. Broadway really depends on which film company has it, because the film companies now wrap up the stage rights, and like the guy who has Lamb absolutely will not let them do. I've had four big Broadway producers come to me about Lamb, and the guy who has the film won't let them do it. You know, so that's out of my hands. Stupidest Angel might happen because, you know, Carl, who has it, he'll do anything to make money. Carl was like making my action figure. I'm like, you know, Carl, only about 8 people know who I am. So that could happen, but some of them are locked up. And I want to get that guy's question because he got intercepted before. What was your question, sir?
I'm curious if when you finish a book, do you have some ritual, some rite, something that you go, when you finally turn it in, you jump to the period at the end of the sentence, is there something you do to celebrate?
Is there something I do to celebrate finishing a book, some ritual? I usually go to the cafeteria of the Chicago Institute of Art. And I look for somebody eating green beans. I really don't. I mean, I finish it and there's just this huge, oh man. But immediately I can't read. I hate reading my stuff. I mean, usually because of deadline, I have to turn right around and go back through it because I don't rewrite till I'm done with the first draft. It's just like I don't have a ritual for finishing a book. I don't even go out to dinner or anything like that. I just sort of, I might, you know, order a pizza and go, I don't care, you know? For 1 minute of my life, I don't have a book due. You know, I mean, I do, of course, have a book due always. But you know, you can just go, I don't have to worry about, I've got a book. Because that's the thing that you say is the contingent of everything. It's like, do you want to go do yada, 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 yada? No, I have a book due. And it's great. But it's like having a term paper due on Monday your whole life. And so anything I do that isn't involved in getting that book, that's why I don't take vacations. I go on research trips. Bless you. And I do have authority for that, having written a Jesus book. Sorry to disappoint you, but I don't. So let's do two more questions, and then I'll sign books for you. Yeah.
What's the craziest idea that you come up with that you have not yet turned into a book?
The craziest idea that I have a lot of crazy ideas that I haven't turned into. There's ones that I would like to do something with that I just don't know what I would do. You know, like polar bears on a train. Which I've had, since Snakes on a Plane, came out. I was like, that kind of interesting, but it'd be really interesting. And I sort of have a way to get them on a train, I figured that out, but I just don't know how to get them on a train. I don't know what for, it wouldn't make a, no, it's not a novel idea. And sometimes I have ideas that aren't book ideas. And so they if they don't find some other, like The Griff wasn't a book idea. It turns out it wasn't a very good graphic novel idea either, but it definitely wasn't a good novel idea because it was written as a film. So we wrote it as a film and then adapted it to a graphic novel. So I, Polar Bears on a Train would be one. Meerkat Pizza Delivery. which I've sort of gotten out of my system by writing it on Twitter and Facebook. Those are the ones that come to mind. But there's so many that the whole thing you're trying to do is not pay attention to those, because that's one of the worst things when you talk to writing students and they go, you don't want to go, well, that's just a stupid idea. And they go, but I have 400 pages. And it's like, and 5 years of my life, I'm really sorry. It's a dumb idea. I have that feeling halfway through every book I've ever written. I have the this is a stupid idea moment. But now I'm 500, or 150 pages into it. It's like, I got to finish it. It's due. They're out there sometimes. None come to mind right now because I'm only working on, very light oxygen. But, okay, one more question. Gentleman here. I think one of the red cars was on Facebook. I did a series in the notes. They moved Facebook around, because evidently we were finally able to navigate it. And they're like, oh, well, let's fuck that up. But in the notes, I think I released like 6 or 8 of my paintings that I did when I was trying to learn how to paint, and one of them is one of the red cars. It's a red Citroen that actually parks in my neighborhood that has it's a CV2, which is a CV2 for those of you who are non-Franken Franken speakers. And it's a goofy looking car, and it has the license plate culottes, which is which is French for panties. And so I took a picture of it on my way to fucking French class one day, and because I kind of tried to learn French, I went to the Alliance classes, which were taught in the Tenderloin, so I had to walk through the Tenderloin to get there in the morning, and I would like step over the dead crack hose and stuff. And it was really, I think that's why I didn't learn, that's my reason why I didn't learn French. It was too dangerous. So you guys, Heather, you want to do logistics? How do we want to do this?
Logistics.
Heather's going to tell you what to do. She will be the boss of you. I will sign all the books you brought. I will personalize a couple. That means, like to Bob or, whoever named Bob. And thanks again for coming, you guys. Appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.